The work of embracing the awkward, getting into our good awkward, is twofold. There's the mindset work we need to do, and then there's an actual active conditioning element to this. So let's start with the mindset work. We actually need to slow down our thinking a little bit as it relates to this emotion, because most of the time when it comes to emotions of discomfort, if we haven't stopped to do some analysis of what that emotion represents, it's very difficult to move through that same emotion the next time. And so first step is do a little bit of a deep dive into your own background, your upbringing, your history. I, in particular, was born into a South Asian family, and I recognized that I was very deeply conditioned to care what will other people think, not what's good for me, not do you enjoy this and does this bring you laughter or love or light. And so for a long time, I had to really re-examine the messages about what it meant for me to put myself out there in a social setting.
The idea of job security is outdated as a landline. If you haven't been in a search for a while, it's probable you will at some point, by choice or not. Most executives admit to staying way too long, or sense what's coming, and justify staying anyway. Here, there's another reason. The faulty belief that navigating to what's next will inevitably be worse and has to suck. Screw that. Lauren Greif has spent a lifetime in corporate and executive search, calling bullshit on stale career advice that most still use. This is Career Blast in a Half, the career podcast for executives ready to cut past outdated career advice to fuel your outcomes now. So let's go.
We're talking awkward. We're talking good awkward. And I'm excited because our guest today is Hannah Pryor. And one of the reasons why I'm so excited about having her here is not only because she just launched her new book, Good Awkward, but also because I'm awkward. And I really, really, really want to be in good company with awkward, because it's just one of those things that until I actually stumbled across Hannah, I thought that you had to like hide your awkwardness. In fact, I thought you had to like pretend you didn't even have it. And so thank you so much, Hannah, for being here today. And I am dying to hear how you not only created this whole coined phrase and how it's just sweeping across the nation, but also how this applies to us in our professional life and our job search. So welcome to Career Blast and a Half.
Thank you for having me. And I had to smile, Lauren, when you were kind of talking about, I felt like it was just me. I felt like I have to get rid of it. And I think that if there's one overarching theme from everyone when they talk about this emotion in particular, it's, gosh, I felt like it was just me. It's just me. You can't, other people can't possibly feel this to the degree that I feel it. And some of the best research that came out of this book is, oh, honey, it is not just you. It is not just you, your friends. It is not you. It is everyone, all neurotypical, you know, kind of socially, you know, neuronormative folks feel this emotion to some degree. And I think that's empowering to know that we're not alone in it. So I'm excited to talk more about it.
Yeah. And I just feel like I need to like politely call you out. You look everything but not good awkward. All right.
Which like, cracks me up. I love when people say that. That cracks me up, because that is not the experience that I've lived growing up. That is not the experience. You know, to this day, I still snort when I laugh. I drop stuff all over myself. I say the wrong thing constantly. Most of my formative years, I felt extremely awkward. I said the wrong thing. I did not, you know, kind of fit in with the groups of friends that I wanted to be a part of. My clothes were different. My food was different. You know, there wasn't a day that went by that made me feel like I was part of the social norm, and the version of myself that I wanted other people to see never, and I don't speak in absolutes often, never matched the version that people saw on display. And so whatever version people see today, you know, I'm a keynote speaker for a living, whatever version people see today, what I try to tell them is this is not some elimination of awkwardness. I still don't look in the mirror and see a cool girl. it's actually a result of me over the years leaning harder and harder into it and owning it and embracing it, where that filter, that thing I was trying to keep between me and the rest of the world, taking it down is, I think, what this, you know, perceived confidence that people see now, that's where it came from. There was no cool version, and I don't think there ever will be.
Okay. So, I mean, this just begs the big question. So what was the turning point between, oops, I want to just like hide under a rock, pretend I'm not awkward, to, you know what? Like, awkward's like not so bad.
Yeah. I wish I could say there was a turning point. I think I still want to climb under my desk sometimes, you know? And so I think the insight moment, more than the turning point, was recognizing that awkwardness cannot be eliminated. It cannot be eliminated. This emotion lives inside of uncertainty. So when we, you know, feel awkward in a given moment, it's typically because we expect an interaction to go a certain way. We expect someone else to respond to us a certain way. We expect us to sound a certain way. And that expectation that we created in our mind wasn't met. So it creates this emotion inside of uncertainty. What I have come to realize is, again, for those who are in every general sense neurotypical, is that emotion, unless you can somehow solve for uncertainty, is unavoidable. So what I started to work on instead was my comeback rate, because I'm going to feel it. I'm going to feel it again tomorrow. I'm going to feel it again the next day. And so I stopped trying so hard to get rid of it and avoid it. And rather, when it inevitably happened, which it still does, I've created strategies and mindsets to get good at embracing those moments so they don't hold me. I can move through them very quickly. So the comeback rate is what changed things.
Oh, I cannot wait to get to the comeback rate, because what I also know is that in your experience, right, it's like the good awkward actually is now like the good catalyst. And so I would really love you to explain how this kind of like evil emotion, this like icky thing, has turned or morphed into something that we can all use as a way to, in your words, maybe help to ride through those waves of uncertainty, or to be able to really like get past this idea that somehow I'm different and I can't do it.
Yeah. I think that this is where maybe some definitions are helpful. So in the spirit of our conversation today, what is the emotion of awkwardness? So first thing is, it's an emotion of discomfort. So I am not sadly here to tell anyone, hey, we're all going to start feeling really great every time that emotion comes up. That's not what the good part of good awkward means. Unfortunately, it feels pretty bad. No matter what the circumstance, in the moment, it is an emotion of discomfort. It is also a social emotion, meaning we don't tend to feel it, or at least not very acutely, when we are by ourselves. So if I'm at home and I'm practicing for a presentation and I brutally mispronounce someone's name, but the only person here to hear it was my dog, I don't typically feel that awkward about that. Maybe a little, oh, I didn't get that right, but I don't typically feel awkward about it. Now, I do the presentation in front of a group of peers, and I mispronounce someone's name and get corrected, that's a very different situation, right? It's a social emotion. And awkwardness typically exists between two walls. It's an emotion that we experience when the person we believe ourselves to be, our true self, is momentarily at odds with the person who we think they see on display. So here I am, smart, polished, capable. I try hard to pronounce people's names correctly, and they see this careless dodo that doesn't actually know how to say someone's name or has the care to say someone's name. In that moment, or moments, depending how long we ruminate on it after, right, we feel the emotion of awkwardness. And so when we think about the way it shows up for us at work, one of the first understandings we have to anchor into is, when we are in a hope to raise our career profile, when we are trying to advance in our career, when we want to take risks or grow in our career, the one thing that we can all expect is a series of inflection points. you know, a series of transition points, whether it's going for a new job, whether you're trying to go for a promotion in your current company, whether you're stepping from corporate to entrepreneurship, whether you're out of school and taking your very first job for the first time. What we know about careers is they are, especially in the era we now live in, they are rarely predictable and linear. At least in some way, you're going to have inflection points along the way. And every time we're at one of those inflection points, it's going to kick up our need for social belonging and social acceptance. And we become hypersensitive to social emotions of discomfort, like awkwardness, like embarrassment, like having a cringe moment. But again, Lauren, they're unavoidable. So our work, our professional growth edge, is to become really good at those moments, because they're coming, whether we want them to or not.
Thank you for dispelling this myth, number one, that it is somehow going to go away. Because, Hannah, you know, and I know, that's a fantasy.
And never happening.
Right. When you talk specifically about leaning into these moments, how do we get to the reframes? Like, how do we, like, here I am in this awkward moment, like I'm wearing a white shirt and I just am at a networking event and I spill something on myself and I feel like a total jerk and like a slob, right? Like, and I look like a sloppy person. How do we reframe those?
Sure. So the work of embracing the awkward, getting into our good awkward, is twofold. There's two pillars to this. There's the mindset work we need to do, and then there's an actual active conditioning element to this. So let's start with the mindset work. We actually need to slow down our thinking a little bit as it relates to this emotion, because most of the time when it comes to emotions of discomfort, if we haven't stopped to do some analysis of what that emotion represents, it's very difficult to move through that same emotion the next time. We tend to find that those patterns just repeat themselves. Mm-hmm. And so just first step is do a little bit of a deep dive into your own background, your upbringing, your history. I, in particular, was born into a South Asian family. My parents are Indian and Pakistani, respectively. And I recognize that I got some very strong messages about caring about the approval of others. So if you have any South Asian listeners, they might recognize this phrase. My parents would say, "Lo kya kenge," which means, what will other people think? You know, if you do that, henna lo kya kenge, what will other people think? I was very deeply conditioned to care what will other people think, not what's good for me, not do you enjoy this and does this bring you laughter or love or light, what will other people think? And so for a long time, I had to really re-examine the messages about what it meant for me to put myself out there in a social setting or to take a risk or raise my hand in a meeting. So first, do that analysis. The second thing, and I think the big thing, there's a number of mindset things we talk about in the book, but the biggest one is this, is slowing down to do a reframe requires that first part, which is slowing down. So awkward moments are inevitable. We don't often plan for them. So after you've had one or a little embarrassing slip up, ask yourself, what kind of story am I now holding about that moment? Are you telling yourself a contamination story, which is, well, I tried to raise my hand in the meeting and that was a total flop. I'm never doing that again. That experience, that emotion of awkwardness or discomfort contaminated the future. Or can you slow down long enough to find the redemption story, the gift in the garbage? You know, kind of stuck my foot in it. That didn't go the way I hoped. But here's what I am proud of. I raised my hand. I don't normally do that in that meeting. My team had my back. I don't think they, you know, killed my career over that. How can I use that as a lesson going forward? But actually having that retroactive following a moment like that takes work. It requires slowing down and making some of our mindsets, internal narrative, external. What actually happened there? What am I holding? Most people don't take the time to do that. And then the patterns repeat themselves over and over around that emotion.
So as I'm hearing you talk about this, it's occurring to me, it's like all starting to become clearer. And I'm curious, is your path, and let's just say Brené Brown, so you could be in some good company here.
Oh, sure.
Is the relationship between vulnerability, her topic, and awkwardness, are they like second cousins, first cousins, third cousins? Because it takes such vulnerability to kind of say, yeah, you know, that happened.
Yeah,
I did.
I love that you asked this. A lot of times people will ask me, you know, a version of that. What is the relationship between these two emotions? So they are similar in many ways, but I would say the big distinction between awkwardness and vulnerability is awkwardness is slightly lower on the level of emotional exposure. Mm. So they both involved a degree of, you know, kind of putting yourself out there, a potential for failing, a potential for it not going right. Vulnerability is a little higher on the level of emotional exposure and emotional disclosure that people are looking for. Awkwardness is one step below that. So I often describe awkwardness as a necessary stepping stone to vulnerability, because often we see leaders who struggle to achieve true vulnerability in their leadership. And then what they do instead, which is so dangerous, and we can all sniff it out from a mile away, is that faux vulnerability of, oh, I'm sorry you all didn't get your raise. I got my fat bonus, but this is still really hard for me. And we're like, okay, like, no, it's not, right? Please, that's just irritating. Right. It's that faux vulnerability versus, you know, a stepping stone to an awkward interaction or a potentially awkward feeling as a leader might look something like, you know, I don't really love to admit this, but I don't know what to say here. This is uncomfortable for me and I don't quite have the words. So I don't want to say the wrong thing. Right? It's not vulnerable. It's not, wow, I'm really struggling as a leader. But it's also the willingness to just say, I don't quite have it here. But if you can't get comfortable in that little imperfect, messy middle first, then true vulnerability to me is still a bit out of reach. We can't jump to that if we can't get comfortable here first.
Oh, this is super helpful. So I'm gonna change my answer. It's like more like a third cousin once removed.
Sure. Yeah. I think they're siblings. I think they're on each other's family reunion invite list.
Okay.
But you know, I think vulnerability requires a bit more emotional maturity and not everyone's there yet.
Ooh, that's a really good way of putting it. I know that in the book you talked about some practical tips. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about these practical tips because, again, those two things seem kind of antithetical. Like, how am I supposed to practice being awkward, right? And
yeah.
how do I get through what you have already so clearly identified as it ain't going away? So
yeah.
How do we start building the awkwardness muscles so that when those situations show up, it is not necessarily taking us down and causing the delay in the rebound.
Yeah. I love the phrase that you just used. How do we help it not take us down? So let's use the easiest low hanging metaphorical kind of equivalent, physical fitness. Now, if you go into the gym and you have never been in the gym or it's been years since you've been in the gym and you try to lift that 300-pound barbell, guess what? That thing's going to take you down. Your back's going to go out. You're not going to feel good, right? That is not a good way to do things. So what do? We start small. We start slow. Social fitness is the same. It is the same thing, and we need to treat it the same way. So just for some foundation here, what we're facing as a country, as a society, is a decline in our social musculature. And I want to just be very clear, this is not just introverts. In fact, you know, for all the ways I feel awkward, I am not an introvert. I am an extrovert. But what we are discovering is that thanks to, you know, a pandemic that occurred, but also just things that were building well before that, technologies, we do not have to have real life social interaction as much as we used to. So on this day, Lauren, if I don't feel like talking to anybody, guess what? I can order my lunch on DoorDash. It'll be at my door. Somebody will drop it off. If I wasn't happily married for 18 years, I could swipe and go on a date. I could Slack my teammates, you know, DM, text. I don't really have to talk to anyone. And what we're missing with all this asynchronous stuff is the chance for things to go kind of off the rails. Right? For them to accidentally mispronounce my name, for me to bump into someone and go, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, I spilled something on you. We're getting out of practice on those moments of uncertainty of what happens in a social setting when we actually have to respond in the moment, in real time. And so then all of a sudden, we get to the big wait. We get to our negotiation for a new job, for a new salary. We put ourselves out there for the promotion. We have a big client presentation, and it feels that much harder because we've had no social reps. We've had no repetitions. And so what can we do? Part of this is mindset. The other part is conditioning. So I'm going to make it very tactical. As an individual by yourself today, I'm going to challenge you to do a couple of things. If you work in an office, the next time you go onto the elevator, don't hammer the elevator door button shut. See what it might feel like to just have a quick conversation with someone. If you're in the grocery store checkout line, just for a few extra minutes, leave your phone in your bag or in your pocket. Catch eyes and smile. They may not smile back. It doesn't matter. It's about the fact that you did it, right? I'm not here for the result. I don't care. It's about the fact that you did it. Coffee shop, Subway, leave the headphones out just for a few minutes, if not the whole time, just for a few minutes. But these are all slow ways for us to re-engage social muscles that are increasingly becoming dormant. You know, my husband the other day, we were trying to order online for tacos and it wasn't working. And I suggested that he call. And he was like, oh God, no, let's just get pizza. Now, bear in mind, my husband is in sales, Lauren. He's in sales for a living. And I'm like, just call. What are we talking about? But this is everyone these days. Increasingly, we just don't want to be bothered. And there is a cost. So mindset is one half. Conditioning in small moments is the other half. And we can all do these things.
Well, what this is also starting to stir up in me is this in parallel and in crossover to a lot of the push to return to work. Mm-hmm. And how it is, I was watching the news last night and Tony Robbins was talking about a recent retreat that he went on with, you know, Mark Benioff and all these guys. And they're all like, well, guess what? We're all going back to work. Mm-hmm. We're all mm-hmm. going back to the office because you cannot effectively long term be able to build the kind of relationships that happen during a handshake.
Yeah.
That happen when you are picking up the nuances in people's expressions. And so I think what I hear you saying is, you know, start test driving. Start doing things now.
Yeah. I mean, as a working mom, the return to work thing is a tough one, right? Because there's benefits to having the flexibility, the remote structures, there's benefits to the social interaction. So, you know, I think even as someone who really believes deeply in the power of increasing our social fitness, still there's nuance, right? There's other things that we need to consider. But that said, it can't be either or, right? It's got to be. So even for those, I have some, you know, clients and colleagues who work in fully remote structures and they say, well, what if I can't? What if I can't be in the office with people? You can still exercise your social fitness virtually. The goal is less asynchronous. Maybe it's a 5-minute coffee chat with your peer with, you know, before a meeting or first thing in the morning. Again, the goal is to find moments for conversation to go wherever it goes. And not be able to know that this is what it's going to be. It's that uncertainty tolerance that we're trying to increase in social situations. But in remote settings, those things don't just happen on your calendar. We actually have to now create them. There's an intentionality that has to be built in. But anyone can do it, no matter what their working structure is.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that. And I would love you to kind of rewind us a little bit on the rebounds. Like, how do I come back? How do I, like, save face? How do I do the things that I need to do to kind of, like, pull myself together? Because I've been there. You've been there. I mean, whatever. I tripped over my dress. The heel of my shoe broke. I don't even know what happened. But it's just uncomfortable. And so how do I do this in a way that's authentic?
Yeah.
And also doesn't like take it to the spiral.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you a couple strategies. The first is mindset related. The second and third are more action oriented. The mindset related one, I think, is just, it's a helpful realization and it lives in the research on two fronts. First of all is Tom Gilovich out of Cornell University has well documented research around the spotlight effect. So if you do say something awkward or embarrass yourself, more often than not, people are not paying as close attention to you as you think. They are not staring at you going, oh my God. They might be looking at you momentarily, but guess what? Within seconds, they're already back to thinking about, well, do I look like an idiot right now? Am I about to say something next? right? Most humans are wired that way. We're not the center of other people's worlds. So we have to kind of watch out for that, you know, protagonist disease or main character, right? We like to think everyone's obsessing over our awkward moments. Guess what? They're not.
They don't.
Right? Yeah. The second thing is on the mindset piece is just be careful not to confuse awkwardness with ineptitude. So a lot of times when people have an awkward moment, they start to tell themselves a story of that person thinks I'm an idiot or they think I don't get it or whatever it may be. These are two separate things. Ineptitude implies a lack of skills or a lack of intelligence in a certain area. That's not what we're talking about here. And in fact, one of my favorite pieces of research is research done by Elliot Aronson about the pratfall effect, which is if you are generally someone who is perceived by their peers, leaders, colleagues as hardworking, smart, you know, competent, generally someone who gets it done, and you stick your foot in it or you commit a blunder, actually, not only does that not make you a horrendous human in their eyes, in fact, the pratfall effect tells us that those tiny little missteps make you more warm and likable because it actually kind of puts the pedestal away. That little lack of perfection puts other people at ease. And so while I'm not, implying that you purposely dump coffee in your lap, just understand that if you are generally someone who shows up as prepared, competent, intelligent, hardworking, and that happens to you, relax. Actually, people may even like you more for it. So those mental shifts are important. Now, in the moment, just quickly, these actionable things, we can use a couple strategies. First of all, we can name it. One of the funny things about awkwardness is the avoidance of awkwardness increases awkwardness. So when we have one of those moments, rather than letting the tension just hang in the air, for those of us who can practice saying it, it's sometimes very easy to go, whoosh, that was awkward, right? Or, oh, I really cringing at myself here, right? That was the wrong thing to say. The quicker we name it, the quicker it cuts the tension and diffuses. Mm. And then the second, and we can also strategically use humor. Now, the way we use humor, there are some rules, and the book has a whole chapter about how to do it. You know, we got to be careful with how. Self-deprecating humor is great when it comes to diffusing awkwardness, but a rule is not about the things that you're supposed to know. So, for example, if I'm a tax accountant, I wouldn't use self-deprecating humor around an awkward moment relating to my tax skills or my tax knowledge, right? It can be about not being particularly athletic or graceful, right? There's just making sure that we're careful how we use it, but having strategies and talk tracks around how to diffuse those moments in real time when they come. And sometimes those just take practice, but we can create a little arsenal of things that work for us.
Mm, so good. I appreciate also that nuance. As you were talking about that, I immediately started thinking about a lot of folks that we work with. They're part of our listeners. They're everywhere, right? I'm one of them. Mm-hmm. It's people who are working through ageism. So you're not going to be able to say, you know, I had a senior moment. That's
right.
That's not where you're going.
Right. Yeah.
I would love for you to talk about your suck method, the suck method.
Yes.
Because that's kind of awkward just right there, right?
Yeah. And, love it.
And I think that this is just an amazing framework and ways for us to think about it, because it sounds like something that's easy to remember. And I think it also can really, really help us to be able to work through it.
Yeah, absolutely. So when people say, you know, how do I start conditioning my awkward muscles? They know that, okay, the mental shifts need to happen and it also needs to be a conditioning element. So how do we start? You know, I think we've touched on some of it, but SUCK is an acronym. How do we seek out the SUCK? So the first is we look for small moments. I think we already had some great examples in this conversation, you know, keeping the phone in the pocket at the grocery store line, potentially, you know, catching eyes and smiling at someone in a coffee shop. Again, people worry, like, are they going to think I'm creepy? This is why we have a loneliness epidemic, everyone. No, everyone is craving connection or just come, you know, what's awkward sometimes that makes everybody feel good? A compliment. Hey, I like your shoes. You know, these are things that people deem awkward, but the payoff is so high. Start small. If you're not quite ready to raise your hand in that huge meeting, then practice your muscles in these smaller stakes situations. So S is for small. The U is for uncomfortable. So yes, the small things probably naturally have some of that built in, but there's actually some interesting research around finding things that are slightly at that uncomfortable growth edge, because research finds that when we even display our awkward discomfort around others, again, assuming that we are seen as capable, competent, and smart, that people actually find us more endearing, more likable, more generous, and more forgivable. And people hear that and they're like, really? Expressing my awkward discomfort makes people, why? Because your lack of perfection puts other people at ease. So if you have a moment where you feel uncomfortable, lean into it, own it. Believe it or not, it doesn't have the adverse effect. It has a very positive effect on the people around you. The C is looking for cringe chasm moments. So small and uncomfortable. You know, we're off to the races, right? Small and uncomfortable, great. But maybe, you know, smiling at someone in the grocery store with your phone in your pocket. Yeah, you feel a little way, but it's not catastrophic to you. We do have to still look for some of those moments where we're crossing the cringe chasm, that point where we're like, okay, something is stopping me from getting in the way of where I want to go. My goals are over there on the other side of this chasm. And I have to be willing to tolerate a little bit of that nasty in my stomach and just do the thing or say the thing. But the important part about cringe chasm moments, and this is a hard rewire, it's not about whether or not it worked. It's not about whether or not you jumped and you made it to the other side successfully. It's about the fact that you jumped, that you did the thing. And I want you to stop and celebrate that. So my favorite example of someone who sort of conditioned these muscles is CEO Unilever, Lena Nair, was trying to get better at speaking her voice into meetings. You know, it was often a lot of males in the room, and she really was just trying to condition this muscle. So what she did was she would have a pencil and a notebook quietly in front of her, and every time she spoke up in a meeting, she gave herself a star. And if she spoke up, if she doubled down on an idea, she gave herself 2 stars. Now notice, it's not about whether people liked her idea. It's not about whether they went forward with it. But she wanted to celebrate, I hate doing this. It makes me feel very awkward and uncomfortable and embarrassed. And I did it anyway. That's what she was celebrating. So creating mechanisms to look for those cringe chasm moments and cross. And then lastly, the K is just keeping perspective. We touched on this too. You know, kick some A, first of all. But then also keep perspective, which essentially points to this idea that we talked about before. People are not watching you as closely as you think. They are not obsessing over your awkward moments. And the sooner that you can remind yourself of that, the sooner you can get back to the work that needs to be done. But we often, you know, especially in this digital world, we feel like we're in a fishbowl. Everybody's watching us. It is too easy to feel like everyone is staring at our every move. Even if they are looking at you for a moment, rest assured, we're all a little self-absorbed right now. We're back to ourselves, lickety-split. So just keep that perspective throughout.
Yes. I had a friend that says the ego repairs itself very quickly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly right. Back to everyone, look at me.
Exactly. First, before we get into the signature questions, I need to just take a commercial break and tell you right off the bat, congratulations on your book. Your TED Talk, your keynote speaking. It is so wild and refreshing to be able to hear this on so many different platforms across so many different mediums. And I'm just thrilled and delighted that your awkwardness is a message that we are all embracing. And so congratulations to all of that.
Thank you.
As we are wrapping this up, one of the things that we do here in our signature questions is we start off and ask you what we should put on our Post-it. What we should put on a Post-it nearby, whether it's suck, whether it's something that gives us either permission to embrace the awkwardness or something that's here. Maybe even you have one.
I have a personal mantra that I try to live by, and I have a few ways I typically answer questions like this, but I'm going to share this today because it feels very on my heart. Take your work seriously, but not yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I take my work extremely seriously, but the minute I start taking myself too seriously, it all falls apart. I'm doing it for all the wrong reasons. I'm looking for everyone else's approval. Take the work seriously, but not yourself.
So I know you've also been very generous in sharing a lot of your resources and research and all that good stuff. What else? I mean, of course, we will have a link to your book, but any other kind of pivotal research or places that you would go if somebody is really looking also to have some additional support around awkwardness or maybe even vulnerability?
Sure. Yeah. I think, you know, this topic dances nicely with a lot of things around, you know, we already talked about our queen, Brené Brown, and all of her work on courage and daring greatly and the gifts of imperfection. Those are wonderful books. You know, I really like any of the books, especially for women. You know, the Confidence Code by Shipman and Kay is just, it's research heavy, but in that way it's refreshing because you're like, this is not their opinion. This is actually the truth in the way that our confidence is shaped. I think those are excellent. And you know, honestly, I really try to seek inspiration from unlikely places. You know, I think for me, a lot of, books on sales and influence I find interesting because I think oftentimes when we find ourselves paralyzed by what will other people think, it's because we're trying to drive something forward and finding ourselves stuck. So I tend to really enjoy books that have to do with psychology and human behavior or human performance. I listen to Tim Ferriss's podcast often. I like Adam Grant's Hidden Potential. I like Hidden Brain. There's a lot of, you know, any books that can talk about human psychology and human thinking in a way that might, you know, look for an episode that helps you unlock something that you hadn't thought about. And I think any of those things can feed our own narratives around who we are and how we show up.
Fantastic. The last question is usually both awkward and mind refreshing, which is, what's your walk-up song?
My walk-up song is This Is How We Do It by Montel Jordan. I love that song. I love all 90s hip hop, but that's my song.
Yeah, me too. Me too. That's actually a really good choice. I like it.
I love it.
You had it on the ready. Amazing.
Because I will request it every time. Like, if I have a choice, it's that one. Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Henner Pryor, where should we come and find you aside from LinkedIn? Where should we point people to and so that they can get your book and all the good stuff and hire you for speaking and on and on and on?
I appreciate it. Yeah, LinkedIn is my preferred playground. HennerPryor.com will redirect you to my website. GoodAwkward.com has a bit more information about the book, but it's everywhere books are sold, Amazon, Target, Barnes & Noble, et cetera. And I don't find it awkward at all. Link up, talk to me. No pressure, and really just grateful for the space to have such a rich conversation. So thank you for having me.
Such a blast. Such a great time. Thank you. Thank you. And for those of you who are still listening, thank you so much for your listening ears. And please, you know what I'm going to ask you to do. I'm going to ask you to do us a solid. Please write us an Apple review on podcast. This is how we are growing. And we just crossed the 1.5%. We're so excited globally of podcasts. So we're working it, and we're working it really for you because we want to help you zoom past stinky career advice and be on top of all of what is happening to keep you relevant and also to keep you excited about work you love. So for now, thank you. Thank you. And I will see you again next week.
Thank you for joining today. We appreciate your listening ears big time. We ask this, use these tools, not tomorrow, right now, and share them by spreading the love, leaving us a rating and subscribe so you don't miss the next career blast in a half. Most of all, thank you for you.